He's defeated every champion from every organization the sport of mixed martial arts has ever seen, and retired from the octagon as the biggest draw and the industry's highest paid athlete of all time. And now, JL Sonnen's on PodcastOne.com. And for that, you're welcome.
I'm JL Sonnen, and you're listening to Your Welcome. Big congratulations to myself, as here we are in the inaugural weeks of this new podcast, You're Welcome. We went from number 14 all the way up to number 1, held that spot, and we're very proud of that. Now, on today's show, we are going to have George St. Pierre, UFC welterweight champion, possibly the only guy to ever leave the sport as the champion. It's generally something you get beat out of, forced out of the sport. He left on his own accord. We're going to find out if he's coming back. Hearing rumors that he is. Also in the program, we are going to have WWE writer John Pimarini. That's going to be fun. Amongst other things, we're going to get his opinion on Brock Lesnar, if Brock will return. I think that's probably more of just a commentary than a likelihood. But we're going to find out what he thinks. We will be back in just a moment. And when we return, we will be on the phone with George St. Pierre. This is Your Welcome, everybody.
Have you heard Who's Next with Goldberg?
Yes, sir!
Every Tuesday, wrestling legend Bill Goldberg hangs out with his well-known friends from the NFL,
Deion Sanders.
How you doing, my friend?
The Ring.
Talking with my very good friend, Diamond Dallas Page.
Chuck Cito!
Cito!
Plus, he might even answer your wrestling questions.
It's a dream come true, man. Thank you for answering my questions.
So find out Who's Next with Goldberg.
Putting some content together that you ain't never heard before.
Every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com. You're listening to Your Welcome with JL Sonnen.
All right, we're back to Your Welcome, and as promised, we are joined on the line by the one and only, the welterweight champion, apparently retired, but we're going to get to the bottom of that right now, Mr. George St. Pierre. George, what's going on, pal?
Doing well, yourself?
Never better, my friend. I'm happy to be talking to you. I've got a lot of questions for you. And first off, let's just start out with the retirement. I'm reading things online. It says George St. Pierre is back. And then there's always a little asterisk next to it, and it says in training. Is St. Pierre back, or is he just back in the gym?
Well, I'm going to tell you the truth. I always train. I started training when I was 7 years old, and I never stopped since. Training is part of my life, so it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean I'm going to be back or not. It's just that training, whether if I retire or not, or if I come back or not, I'm always going to be training. I like to feel in shape, you know, to feel good in my own skin, and for that, that's why I'm training.
Now, George, if you were to come back, let's just play hypothetical. Over history, it's very traditional when a guy steps away, whether you're talking boxing, whether you're talking MMA, when a guy steps away for a little bit and he returns. It is very common that a lot of times he will return in a different weight class. A lot of times the guy's sitting a little bit stagnant. He's not burning the same amount of calories. Maybe a little bit of age gets to him. If you were to come back, would it be at 170 pounds, or would you possibly do like Nick Diaz is doing and come back at middleweight?
I don't know, but the thing is, you know, I'm the bigger I ever been right now. Due to my rehab, I was not able to do like martial art training, so I did a lot of strength conditioning exercise mixed with a lot of gymnastics. So I gained a lot of muscle mass. I'm the heaviest I ever been in my life. I'm like 200 pounds right now.
Whoa!
I used to walk around 188, 190, and now I am 200 pounds. And but still, a 200 pounds, it's a welterweight. The guys now in my division are over 200 pounds.
Sure.
They walk around more than 200 pounds. So even before when I used to compete, I was very small. I have a very large frame that make me look bigger because I have a long reach. But I'm not very heavy. I'm a small guy for the elite of my weight class, actually.
Now, George, when you talk about that, and you've all, I've heard you comment on that plenty of times before. You know, there was always talk of the super fight, Anderson Silva versus George St. Pierre. And size was a concern with you. I have a steadfast belief that in this sport, much like wrestling, jiu-jitsu, or boxing, the heavier you go, the worse the athletes get. I always wanted to fight up in weight class because I was convinced that the bigger the guy, the worse the athlete. Am I wrong about that?
I don't know, because there is always exception to the rules, and I believe Anderson Silva is an exception to the rules. But this, I've been says, the reason why you're, most people think that way, and I think it's not wrong to think that way, it's if you look at the population, most of people weighs about, I would say, 140, 155 pounds. North American people are very, very, very big. But if you look at the most of the population are 150, 155. So it's normal, because there is more people, there is more competition, and there is, because of there is more competition, normally, there, it, statistically speaking, normally it would be logical to think that the best fighter would be at that weight class.
Sure.
But you always have different exception, and I believe there is, it's like boxing, there is different era. There is an era that certain weight class are, they're better than others, and I believe it's the same thing in mixed martial art.
I would agree with that. Now, as we talk about weight, and we talk about comebacks in different weight classes, I can't help but think about Nick Diaz. He's going to be coming back. He's going to be taking on Anderson Silva, who's also coming back. Now, Diaz stepped away after your guys' five-round fight. Anderson stepped away by force. He was dealing with an injury, but they've both been away from the ring. How do you see this match going down?
I think, you know what, to tell you the truth, I would maybe favor Diaz if that fight would have been in a catchweight. I would have maybe favored, because if it's a five-round, Diaz is a very durable fighter. I've seen him in very bad position, in a lot of trouble, and he's very, very hard to finish. Maybe it happened, but I didn't remember to see a guy who finished Nick Diaz, and he's very durable. So the way I see this fight going, and now it's different because they fight in Anderson Silva's weight class, which I believe Diaz made a mistake by accepting that fight at 185. I think he should have made a catch weight. It would have been more fair. But I believe that in the early part of the fight, I believe Silva will have an advantage. But if Diaz can survive and you know, like, how do you say, weather the storm, I believe he can come back strong at the end, the last part of the fight, maybe like the fourth and fifth round. He's a very durable fight, and he brings to the fight, when you fight him, he's talking to you, and he brings a different intensity that I never seen before. And you feel like you're a little bit, you feel like you're claustrophobic a little bit, kind of speak. And you lose a lot of energy because he's constantly pushing you forward, and it's very hard to fight a guy like him, especially in the later round.
Now, I've seen Diaz talk to fighters. You just said Diaz talks to you when you fight. I've seen him do that. I didn't see him do that to you. What, did he say things to you during the fight?
100%. He said a lot of things. He's a very, very smart fighter. Like, behind his, you know, his image and his, you know, the character that he is, he's very smart. And my game plan was, when I fought him, was to not fall into this, you know, because it was important. If I would have fallen into it and get into a slugfest with him, it would have been his fight. I would have fight his fight, and now I would have put myself in the. You would probably have win. That he's the best at that kind of fight. You know, when he's a scrappy slugfest, that's what he's at his best.
Sure. Yeah, no, you're right. He wanted to stand up with you. He wanted to at least try his hand there. He was getting frustrated. He was sick of that double leg. Now, I didn't know that he was talking to you. I think that that's a lot of fun. I wish I knew specific things that he was saying and doing, but, you know, I thought his post-fight speech was great, too. He had some fun there with Joe Rogan. So he's going to be back with Anderson, man. I just think that's a really interesting match. When you talk about Diaz, I can never remember a fight, George, where Diaz has ever lost it standing up. I've seen him lose some fights, but it's generally because he loses position. I've never seen him submitted. and I can't remember a guy outstriking him. I don't think Anderson has the skill set to take him down, but I don't think Anderson's going to try to take him down. So if Anderson beats him, he's going to have to show us a weakness in Diaz we've never seen before.
Well, I believe that Diaz is very good in boxing, you know, and I believe it. A lot of his training is pure boxing. So if you make, he's probably the best boxer in mixed martial art, and if you make the fight, a boxing fight, like a slugfest boxing fight, I believe he's going to win. But the thing with Diaz, when I fought Diaz, I knew I couldn't make a slugfest boxing match. So I cut angle, I stay out of his range, and I dictate when I was going for the exchange. So the reason why it works well is, you know, I mix with the takedown, with the kicks. You need to be very, very versatile and very creative with Nick Diaz.
Now, I want to get into something that you said on the Joe Rogan podcast. George, whenever you do an interview, I try to listen. I'm interested in it. I get fascinated by you as an athlete and as a person. And the same can be said for Joe Rogan. I'm really interested in what he has to say. I think that stuff's fascinating. So when you and he came together, that was a no-brainer for me podcast. Now, you talked about some stuff that I've got into with Joe Rogan before. And I'm talking about alien encounter. I'm talking about UFOs, George. I want to know your opinion. Do we have aliens that have visited this country?
I never talk about alien. I talk about non-identified flying object. And if you don't believe me, one day I was in Albuquerque when I remember a day I was in Albuquerque with Rashad Evans, Mike Van Arsdale, a fighter called Alejandro, who's a Mexican guy, and also Ali, who's an Egyptian guy. He managed a lot of the fighters. I believe he managed Frankie Edgar. We were all in the car. And you could ask any of those guys, Rashad, Mark Van Arsdale, and Ali or Alejandro. We were in a car in Albuquerque, New Mexico, on the highway, and we saw a UFO all together, you know. UFO doesn't mean you see it's an alien. It means it's a non-identified flying object. I don't know what it was. It could have been a light. It's something that we cannot explain. I've seen it. It came straight towards us, and right away it changed direction, and it disappeared. And then I remember it's the first time of my life I saw a UFO, and it was very weird, you know. We talk about it still today, and you know what? When I say UFO, I don't say alien. I talk about UFO. And the thing you talk about with Joe Rogan, it's another thing, you know. It's something that has nothing to do with what I've said, you know.
Sure.
People make a link, but I try to see things in a scientific way, not too much in an emotional way, you know, because sometimes you come in certain conclusion that you make your own conclusion, but doesn't mean it's the truth.
No, George, you're completely right. UFO does not mean it's from outer space or that it's a different life form. It just means it's an unidentified flying object. So then the question comes down to unidentified by who? That means that people in your car have never seen it before. You guys don't know what it is. Does that mean that our government's never seen it? Does that mean our Air Force hasn't seen it? Perhaps it came from a different government's Air Force.
Or maybe it's a natural, it's something that we don't know. Like maybe it's a reflection of a light that make it look like it's a flying saucer or something. We don't know. Like it's stuff that we cannot explain. And on Joe Rogan's podcast, what I talk about, and it's something I'm not ashamed to admit. Since I'm young, and it's not when I started my career, even young, sometimes I have loss of time, of memory, of stuff that happened. And it did not get worse over time. I just lost time of track. Sometimes it's especially at night when I go to bed.
Missing time.
I feel like, yes, I have time. Or it happened to me one time I drove, and I lost like 30 minutes, an hour goes by. You know, stuff, it's very weird stuff. And I heard it, a guy like, I think it's Herschel Walker, it happened to him too, and it's a disease or something. But I have not been diagnosed by that disease that they talk about. So I don't know what it is.
I know what you're talking about.
It did happen to me.
I've read a lot of stuff on that. I had a guy on this show, George, named Jacques Vallée. He's written over a dozen books. He's the leading researcher in the world on on UFOs, alien phenomenon, encounters of the other kind. He's a 77-year-old man. He's got two different PhDs. He's a French researcher. He's testified in front of not only our Congress here in the United States, but also in France. And his ultimate conclusion is that there is a genuine phenomenon of UFO. He can even link it to the United States government, that they have put things out to make people believe this, but he doesn't know why. His ultimate conclusion is we don't have, as a scientist, he's just saying we don't have any verifiable evidence or data. And to make a scientific conclusion, you must have data. He's saying, look, we don't have that. I can't prove that there are aliens, but I can prove there's a phenomenon, and I can prove things have been in the sky that we citizens don't know what they are. But it appears that our government is attempting to release this information to us. And then he goes on to hypothesis why. What do you think about that?
I don't know. You know, like I said, I made a lot of research about this stuff. It's very weird. What I can talk about is only my own experience. When I was young, when I was a kid, and a lot of people will think I'm crazy, but I'm going to tell you the truth about that, and I'm going to come out with something I never said publicly in an interview. When I was young, I used to be scared to sleep alone with my mother and father. And it's something that is really true. I talk to my parents still about it. And I used to at night, I used to run to my parents' room and tell them, hey, I'm afraid the monster is coming to get me. And I remember I used to draw them, the monster that I was talking about. Uh-huh. I said, hey, is the monster coming to get me? And now at that time, as I'm getting older, maybe it's my imagination, or I think it's my imagination, but as time goes by, I stop having those memory of what was happening, and it's kind of weird, you know. It's like sometimes I feel like it's feel like my memory got erased or something, and I talk about it, and people think I'm crazy, but I'm trying to see things in a very scientific way, so I just say I don't know. But my parents, I talked to them, like actually 2 weeks ago about it, and I said to them, "Hey, you remember when I was young, and I told you, like, you know, I lost track of time, and I felt like discomfort, I used to run and to see you, and I say, I'm afraid the monster coming to get me or something." They say, yeah. I say, did it still, what happened? They say, yes. I say to them, it's still, now sometimes I have loss of memory. It happened very rarely, but sometimes I believe I don't even notice it that it happened, but sometimes I do notice it. You know, it's mostly at night, stuff like that happen. But like I said, it could be a, something explained by medically, you know, like I think Herschel Walker have something like that, but I have not been diagnosed with this.
Yeah, I read about that, George. You don't sound crazy in the least bit to me, but what happens is there's a lot of people that are listening to this right now that can relate to everything you're talking about. But people get scared to talk about these things. When you're saying maybe you've seen a UFO, when you're saying, man, I feel like I'm dealing with lost time or the monster under your bed when you're a kid, man, these are real things that people deal with. They just don't like to voice them. You know, so I think you're going to bring comfort to people.
I have no memory. Like, if you ask me about if I ever encounter something or different, I never have no memory of that. I have no memory. I do have memory that if you ask my parents, I used to draw the monster that I talk about. I say, hey, the monster, I used to draw them on a paper. But even if I look at the paper, I have no memory of this. I have no memory that I used to draw them. It's like a part of my life that's been erased. And now I talk about it, it's like empty in my head. Like, I have no memory of that. But wow. I remember something that is 100%, and you can ask Rashad Evin and Mike Van Arsdale, who are known fighter in UFC, if they were with me when we encounter a UFO in the sky. And this I remember. That's the only thing I remember that I could relate to that kind of phenomenon. And you can ask Rashad, and it's a fact. I don't know what it was, but it was pretty crazy. You know, we freaked out when we saw that.
No, that's wild, man, and that's New Mexico. A lot of stories you hear come out of New Mexico. There's a number of people that have witnessed these types of things that are just simply unexplained. Now, to move on from this, George, I want to go back to your career, man. You had one of the most amazing runs there's ever been in the UFC. It's hard for me to imagine that in my lifetime, and I plan to be here another 40 or 50 years, that anybody's going to duplicate what you did. And you did three things, and they're very, very uncommon. First off, you beat everybody of yesterday. You beat the Sean Sherks, the Frank Triggs, the Matt Hughes's, the BJ Penns. You beat all the guys of yesterday. You then beat and dominated everybody of your time. You then, and this is what becomes really rare about your career, George, is you beat the future. You have a win over Johnny Hendricks, who is the sitting world champion. That belt probably is not going to leave his waist anytime too soon. And if it does, it'll probably volley around a little bit. He'll probably get it back, maybe lose it here. He's going to be the guy for a while. You were able to accomplish a lot like what Lennox Lewis did. Lennox Lewis was able to beat Klitschko before he retired. For the next decade, every time Klitschko won, it added to Lennox's legacy. That's something very unique that you have. And I'm not even asking a question there. I just want to tell you, from one sportsman to another, good job. You accomplished a lot. And when they talk about the pound-for-pound greatest fighter, it always confuses me how that's not an absolute lock of GSP at number one. But with that, George, you became the biggest draw in the sport. With being the biggest draw in the sport, as you and I know, if you're cut in on the pay-per-view, if you become an owner of the show that you're on, there is a tremendous financial reward that comes along with that. Jose Aldo is in the same boat with the same contract, but he's just not bringing in the viewership. And therefore, his financial reward, he's not experiencing what, say, you were able to experience. Do you have any advice for Jose Aldo?
Well, one thing I can advise, like the professional athlete in mixed martial art, you have to take it in a way that you need to see your career as a business. I'm not qualified. I'm not competent for business because I'm a martial artist. I'm competent to fight. So when it's time to negotiate deal with my taxes or lawyer, I'm hiring the best people, the people that I could find the most competent for the job. I don't try to do all this stuff myself, or to pick one of my friend, or, you know, a lot of fighters, I believe they got caught up in those kind of things. And I did myself as well. I had a lot of problems. I got, you know, in different law dispute and stuff like that. I lost a lot of money. I made a lot of money, but I could have made way more. I'm lucky because it happened in the beginning of my career, and I learned from those mistakes. But what I can say to the guys that are like champion in mixed martial art, make sure that you find people who are professional and competent to do your job, to manage your business, your social media, your management, and all this, because you know that you're a martial artist. You cannot be good at all those things. You need to find someone who's just as good as you in your sport to do those things. And that's what I did, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, I was not afraid to spend money to make more money.
Sure.
I hire the best to make me get the best that I can have. And I think that's one of the things that people sometimes they lack. You know, they make it. Nothing break my heart more in this world to see like a professional athlete that has an outstanding career, and then when he finish, when he retire, he's broke. I hear that in newspaper and in documentary. I've seen it many times in football, in MMA, and it broke my heart. So please, guys, make sure you're well surrounded, not by friends, by competent people.
Yeah, that's true, George. You know, people do bring in their buddy to manage them, or they bring in some guy that sold them on something, and they do end up getting stolen from, and they do end up getting shortchanged. That's true, but they also have another thing in common, and that is they have very poor spending habits. And a lot of these guys go out and they spend the money like they're always going to be making, and they don't plan for tomorrow. But as I'm talking about Jose Aldo is one of the great fighters of this time, one of the pound-for-pound greats, world champion. The guy is complaining about his money, and I get it. Everybody wants to make more money, and I'm not turning on Jose Aldo. However, I would like to offer the other side, which is he has a very favorable contract. He gets a cut of the pay-per-view. Now, when people hear those terms, George, a lot of times they don't understand it like you and I do. They don't understand about thresholds, and that a threshold means you must meet a certain number before that clause, the pay-per-view clause, is kicked in. As the thresholds go up and the pay-per-view does better, so does your dollar amount. But Jose Aldo, as a champion, is in on that, and that's a tremendous opportunity, but it's nothing more than that. Dana White is not Santa Claus. He is also not a bank. But it is a business, and he is providing a huge opportunity. And now it is up to Jose to bring in the interest and bring in the eyeballs. Am I wrong?
That is true. In a business, it's normal. Everybody will do what is more profitable to them. That's the law of business. You know, but you need you know, the problem when you going up, you have a lot of fake friends, a lot of people that they tell you, oh, you can trust me and this and that. And it happened to me. And I'm not better than anyone else. You know, I got my share of mistake as well. And I made many mistakes. But I got lucky. I have an old friend, like I know from back in the day, even before I became popular. His name is Rodolphe Beaulieu, and he's my manager now. And this guy, even before he had like a job in he had a very serious job before he jumped on board with me, and he always helped me, you know, like on the side, and because, you know, he helped me to the right, you know, it's a mix of everything, you know, you can't always find competent people because you don't know how to choose the competent people, but everyone has someone in their entourage that they can trust who are proficient in certain area, like in business. So even though this guy that you know that is proficient in business that cannot make the jump on board to deal your business, but you can ask him advice about things like, oh, would you know someone who's very good manager or someone who's good in finance or tax? Because, you know, like tax report and things like that. And you need all these competent people to have a good career and assure yourself of a future.
Yeah. Yeah, you do, man. It is like anything. And you are a business. You are an entity and a brand. And I don't think anybody has put more time and more care into their brand, anybody in MMA, than George St. Pierre. I think that's why you ended up with the great sponsorships. You certainly had the mandate of the masses with the fans. And people love to see you fight. People loved watching you fight. You know, I was one of those guys, too. You were a lot like John Jones in that every time you went out there, you had new tricks. I still remember the Koscheck fight where you controlled that entire fight with a jab, which we've never seen you do before. It was a new skill set. You controlled it with a jab, found your takedowns, and out-wrestled the wrestler.
You need in mixed martial arts to be successful, especially when you're a champion, you need to reinvent. You need to reinvent yourself. And in order to reinvent yourself, you need to stay hungry. And one of the reasons also I took a break, it's a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is at one point after my fight with Nick Diaz, and even it happened before I started, like, when I fought Jake Shield, but then I got hurt, took a time off, and I found some of that hunger back. Then I came back after Condit. I had a very good training camp. It was very good. I was very hungry. Diaz, not as good as Condit, but it was okay. And Hendricks was not very good. And I didn't feel that hunger, that will to fight. And at one point, I asked myself the question. I was telling myself, I'm like, look, is that winning the title of the UFC for me? If you would put a scale, for example, when I fought Johnny Hendricks, I was like, if you put happiness on a scale, I told myself, who would be more happy to win a title? It would be me to win another title, or it would be Johnny Hendricks to win the title for the first time? And I realized that the guys who are coming, the new guy, they would be way more happy than me to win a title. And then I realized that myself, like, you know, I lost the motivation, you know, for different kind of reason as well. But then if you lose the motivation, you cannot reinvent yourself. And you stay the same George St. Pierre you are. And for me, it was time for me after the fight. I was like, man, you know what? I need to take time off to see where I'm going. Because I have a lack of motivation, and I don't want to wait until it's too late. You know, if you lose a race in a different sport, you lose a race, it's not bad. But if you lose a fight in mixed martial arts, you get damage. You know, it's very bad, you know.
Sure.
So I wanted to take a time off, see where I'm going, you know. And if I ever come back, you know, it's going to be important for me to reinvent myself, to become a much better version than I was.
George, I really respect that, man. That's something that you always did, is you always evolved. I believe if you come back, you will be better than ever. I am just curious, and I'm going to go ahead and start the rumor now, as to what weight class George St. Pierre may come back in. We may have some super fights in the future. George, I know you are busy. You sent me a text message early. You said, keep me for 30 minutes and let me go. We are exactly at 30 minutes. You are a man of your word for coming on, so I'm going to be a man of my word and let you go, buddy. But I really appreciate you taking the time. Have a great day, George.
Thank you, Joe. Take care.
Cool. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the man right there. World champion, George Rush St. Pierre. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with WWE writer, future Hall of Famer, and my good friend, John P. Marimi. This is your welcome.
There's good news, podcast listener. The Podcast One app version 2.5 update is available right now.
Awesome!
Which means you'll be able to directly access all the shows you really care about anytime and anywhere you want. Adam Carolla, Steve Austin, NPR, Loveline, Dan Patrick, and a whole bunch more.
Wow!
Plus, now you can play, pause, or stop any of your favorites and pick up right where you left off later on. So go to PodcastOne.com now and download app version 2.5. That's PodcastOne.com. Now, back to Your Welcome with Chael Sonnen.
All right, we're back to Your Welcome. Good thing you stuck around. Interesting stuff there with George. I'm now on the line with John P. Marini. John, what's going on, buddy?
Oh, man, you know, I always find a way to get on the biggest marquees with the biggest names.
You did good,
Chael
buddy.
Sonnen, GSP. And John P. Marini, I fit right in.
I think that sounds right. And, you know, George was very... George is a very interesting guy, and I have a different respect for him when I talk to him, because I've worked out with him. I've been in the workout room with George St. Pierre, so I got to feel firsthand what all the hype is about. And I can tell you, as good as people tell you he is. It's legit. He's as strong as an ox. He pays attention to detail. He works hard. He's a pleasant guy to be around, but it is a different deal. You know, when you're a fighter and you're like me and you have a certain shtick and it isn't to put guys over, it's just the opposite. When that's your move, but you get in a workout room and you actually fight with a guy, things change. Same thing as if you're in the cage with a guy. When the fight's over, you leave there with a camaraderie. There's nothing you can do about it. So it was very fun to have George on the line. What did you think about some of the stuff he said? Did he drop any bombshells for you?
You know, being a guy who's really into aliens, extraterrestrial, our past, different sort of histories that we're not, I don't know if it would be not privy to, but maybe not aware of alternative histories of our past. Man, I when he tells those stories, I believe him 100%. And as he's saying it, I'm envisioning exactly what's happening, and I don't doubt it for one second that, you know, whether it's your body, whether it's your mind, whether it's your soul, I believe that there's something out there that could definitely take control of, you know, you in one way or the other. So it's fascinating stuff, man, and you kind of hit it on the head, too. I think there's a lot of people that listen to that and agree with him, and they're afraid to say anything. I mean, I take flack from everybody I know when I read books about this stuff, or, you know, I'm so fascinated with the Ancient Alien TV series. But you know what, man? I mean, who's to say that just because we're not told it's happening, that it's not happening?
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, John, you could even hear the hesitation in George's voice to talk about this. George, let me give you a little background. He went on Joe Rogan, and he said, and he was just a guy speaking freely. He was speaking openly and freely, and of course the backlash comes. George is crazy. George is talking about aliens. That's not what he said. He was just being candid, and he's just saying, man, I've experienced some missing time. And he's also open to say, maybe I need to be diagnosed with something. I'm a fighter. I get hit in the head. Maybe that's the explanation. He's not pointing to aliens, but you could hear the hesitation when I brought it up that he didn't necessarily want to go down that road. And, John, wouldn't you agree? That's what happens to everybody. That's why people don't talk about this stuff, because they get labeled a nut job.
Exactly. And once you say it, you can't take it back. And they're always going to be that's what you're going to be labeled as, too, going forward. I mean, the second you bring anything like that up, people don't forget it. So I can understand his hesitation, especially being the celebrity that he is. But I also think it's people like him that help bring other people out to talk about their experiences. And look, I can believe it. Would I also believe that it's something with him getting hit in the head every day, or it's hallucinations, or someone ate something wrong? Sure. You know, I'm sitting in the middle, but I'm also not one that's going to turn a blind eye to say, hey, if you've got something that I can read or that you can present to me that gives an alternative story of what we're being told, I'm definitely open to hearing it. And I could be swayed either way.
Yeah, you know, when you talk about George, this guy did it the humble route. Okay, he had to win a lot of fights to get over as a star. He came up very slowly, and his shtick was a little bit different. First off, he's a handsome guy, and he always showed up in a suit. He'd always say all the right things, sidestepping profanity about 99% of the time. And then he could go out and he could squabble. He could fight better than anybody. If you were to look back at his career, and that was a good way to go, he broke into the mainstream. He ended up with sponsorships like Bacardi Rum, Under Armour, Gatorade, just to name a few. This guy really did break through into the mainstream. But when I look back at his career, could have he been a little more boisterous, John? I mean, you write for the WWE. You know how this works. You're in the business of selling pay-per-views. George isn't. George is in the business of looking nice and going out and fighting in the octagon. But you were in the business of bringing in those pay-per-view buys. If he was more boisterous, as well as he did, would have he done even better? Or is he the exception to the rule, and he made all of the right moves?
You know, I want to make sure that I before I say it, because it was my instinct to make sure that I actually believe this statement, and I think I do. I think if GSP went the Chael Sonnen route, I don't think it would have taken him as long to be such a star. I think he would have been Brock Lesnar. I think he would have been bigger than Brock Lesnar. He was the guy who could talk and then go back it up. And, you know, I think you did that too as well. And I think that when you started talking, a couple people listened. And then you went out there and you had that performance with Anderson Silva. And then you had people that you had to beat along the way to get back to Silva, Bisping, Stan. And I think people started going, ah, okay, this guy talks and he's also a badass. And I think that GSP could have probably been on the level of a Floyd Mayweather, where people want to see this guy talk, and then he goes in there and he backs it up, and I think people love that. And I think he could have been such a bigger star, although I think when people look back, they will probably say he did it the right way. Now, he could be richer and do it the wrong way, but I think when history goes back, I think that they will look at him a lot better than they will look at most people, and I think that's what history tends to do.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And he's certainly respected, man. You know, the fans like him. The guys in the locker room like him. I don't like anybody, and I like him. I'm putting the guy. I don't have a bad thing to say about him. He's a nice guy. He works extremely hard. He's disciplined, focused. He does what he says he'll do. And he can kick everybody's butt. I don't know what you're going to do about that. Now, look, he was the biggest draw in MMA. And I was the biggest draw in MMA, and I made everybody know this. I couldn't quit saying it. Every time I could open my mouth, I'd talk about it. I'm the highest paid fighter, and I'm the biggest draw in MMA. Now, there was always a asterisk next to that. There was always a little bit more to the story. And what the little bit more to the story was, is when I became the biggest draw, when that happened, Brock Lesnar had quit. Quentin Jackson, known as Rampage, had self-destructed, and George was out with an injury. Those three guys left. Now, it, also, not too long before that, Randy Couture had retired from the sport. Chuck Liddell was done. You know, there was a number of things that had happened, but at the end of the day, all said and done, I was the guy. Now, that window doesn't last you forever. When I tell the story, it's forever. I'm the biggest draw. I'm the highest paid guy. That was a true statement for a small period of time, much like Ken Shamrock was once called the world's most dangerous man. So he just went ahead and kept that title forever, and I respect that. But George, who really was, overall, he got a fight on a lot more pay-per-views than I did. He got a fight on more pay-per-views than Brock Lesnar did. Overall, he sold more pay-per-views and more tickets to arenas than anybody. Shouldn't he talk about that? Shouldn't he be proud of that and go out and brag?
I would, that's for sure. I mean, I think me and you share a similar personality. I'm going to let everyone know. I mean, that is hard work. That man dedicated his life to every single victory that he had. Believe me, I'm going to let everybody know it. But some people just aren't wired that way, and he's a humble guy, and he likes going out there and saying, hey, I respect the guy. I'm going to fight. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to do my best. He beats him, and then when it's done, he sits there and he goes, all right, well, I'm going to celebrate, and then I'm going to go dedicate my life to doing this again, and that's all he wants out of it. I mean, the money's great, but for some people, that's enough. For me, I got to let everyone know what I've done.
Yeah, and you know what? One thing about George that I think people would find endearing, and that guy's, I mean, when we talk about George money, we're talking a crazy number. We're talking $30 million that he's made in the UFC, and I'm not talking about sponsorships. I'm not talking about the millions of dollars a year he does in sponsorships. I'm just talking about the UFC, which in MMA terms, those stories never come out. It's kind of like anything. You hear from the disgruntled guys, but the guys that aren't disgruntled, they don't say anything at all. They just kind of sit there quietly in the corner. But George, John, to my point, George lives in a condo in Toronto, same one that he's lived in when he first broke into the UFC. He drives a car that Dana White gave him for being a coach on The Ultimate Fighter. He lives a pretty simple life. He's not a married guy. He doesn't have any kids. He lives a pretty simple life. Whether he was rich or poor or indifferent, he's doing the same stuff now that he was doing before it all happened. He's getting up and he's going to practice a couple times a day. Maybe he goes out with his buddies and then he does it all again the next day. I think that's a pretty endearing Warren Buffett-esque style story, but that never gets told either.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with you a little bit. You've got $30 million plus whatever that sponsorship money is. Again, you've dedicated your life, your body to this sport that in return has rewarded you. Why you wouldn't take more advantage of that? Now, I'm not saying he needs to go out and blow his money like Mike Tyson did, but I mean, I can't imagine what that condo looks like and how lavish it is if this was something that he had before he got into the sport. I mean, treat yourself a little bit. You know, maybe he does and maybe he doesn't need the cars in the house. But again, he's a different breed from me, at least. I mean, I always say if I won the lotto, I would take half of it and save it, and then I would live off that other half, and believe me, I'd spend every penny of that other half.
Yeah, man, you can't take it with you when you go, and I understand that, but I do argue that people would be endeared to that, that he's a regular guy, whether he made it or not. He's a regular guy, and he lives as a regular guy, and he does the same thing now that he used to do. You know, they say that a rich man can't fight, and I believe that. I believe that that's true. There's exceptions to the rule. Oscar De La Hoya, Floyd Mayweather, they were both exceptions to the rule, but Sugar Ray Leonard said it best. Sugar Ray Leonard, in my opinion, the greatest boxer of all time. He said, you know, it's very hard to get out of bed and go run at 5 in the morning when you're waking up in silk pajamas.
Yes, that is so
you can
true.
Imagine, I mean, it's
did
true.
That affect you?
Yeah, it did. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, motivation. And I always said something, John. I always said, I'm not in this for the money and I'm not in it for the fame. But the reality, and I wasn't. I didn't think. But the reality that subconsciously, at the very least, and possibly even consciously, and I just don't want to admit it, I was motivated by those things. Your ego is on the line. And that comes with the media and the fame. And that is a motivation to go out and work harder. And then the way the pay structure is set up. You know, I was able to get in on the pay-per-view, and that's very rare. Not many guys are given that ability, but when you are given it, you're now a partner. When the show is named after you, when it's called Silva Sonnen or Jones Sonnen or whatever it may be, I now feel part of it. I am part of it. And I get, right, and I get a partake in it, and that is ego-based, and that's also revenue-based. And those are motivations that can go away.
Let me ask you something regarding that, and I'm not asking you to divulge any personal information, just simply asking, how does that work with a fighter? Let's say I get into the UFC and I win my first fight today, and then 3 months from now I win another fight, and I'm gaining popularity, I'm out there talking trash. At what point, what do I have to accomplish for Dana White to call my cell phone and go, I'm giving you a cut of the pay-per-view revenue?
You know, there's a couple of things, and I don't want to speak for Dana, but he has said this publicly a couple of times. If you're a champion in the UFC, you are offered that. They will call you into Las Vegas. They'll fly you out there first class. They will tear your contract up literally in front of you and offer you a brand new one if you win the strap. That's the way that works. Then there is a select few amount of guys where that will just be offered. You can go in and attempt to negotiate for it, but generally there, it is something that they will bring to you when they feel that the time is right or this is the most fair deal. That's something really interesting about Dana. If you want to play cutthroat business, he will play. But if you want to relax and just let him take care of things, you're going to be a lot better off. And if you go in there and you try to negotiate, he'll negotiate. And he'll do it like a regular business deal. And if you play hardball, a lot of times you'll win. A lot of times, wow, you will win. Dana likes to say yes. However, if a show does exceptionally well, you will be bound to what you went in there and fought him for. And the problem is, guys love to say they should be paid more money. And I understand, I want these guys to make more money. I don't want to sound like I'm against that. But if you want to be a partner, John, here's the litmus test that you got to give yourself. If I'm paid X amount of money and the show flops, am I willing to give some of the money back?
Exactly.
If the answer is yes, if the answer truly is yes, then you are a partner and you can go ahead and fight for more money. But if the answer is no, then you have to stop. I see people do this with the big oil companies all the time. Say the oil company should make less money. Well, when the oil market goes down, what are you going to do? Are you going to buy more oil? Are you going to do something to help? No, it's a market. It goes up and down. If you want to be a partner, there's good things, but there's also bad things that come along with that. And if you go in there and you want to take that route with Dana, he will more often than not give you your way, but he will bind you to that.
Agreed. Yeah, I've always wondered that about these athletes that go in there and they'll sit out their contract because they think that they deserve more because of their performance. But you've never heard of a guy walk in there and go, hey, I'm going to give $500,000 back because I didn't meet expectations of the contract that you offered. And I always thought that it would be best in sports where, UFC included, everyone makes a set salary. You come in and everyone makes $100,000 a year. And then what we're going to do for each sport is we're going to set out how much we're going to pay you for each accomplishment you reach. Hey, if it's a home run, you get $50,000. And then the best players will get the most money, and they'll have the most lucrative contract at the end of the year. And every year it's different. But if you're not willing to go in there and go, hey, this year I sucked, pay me half of what we agreed to, you can't walk in there and say, pay me double what we agreed, yep, to, because I was better than you expected.
Now, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, you can't just come forward and say, well, I'm a partner in this, I want to be a partner, when it benefits you. Part of being a partner, you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound, and that comes with good and that comes with bad. And, you know, I do see athletes miss that. And I want these guys to make more. You know, this isn't my message, isn't it? I love that. Good for that. I want them all to make more. I want Dana to make more. I want all of our fans listening to us to make more. I want you to make more. But I do want people to understand, if you're a partner, you're a partner, and there's ups and there's downs that come with it, and you can't just sit back and complain when you're given an opportunity. You know, there isn't a fight into the UFC. People come to me all the time, John, they ask me how they get in the UFC. You could ask me that right now, and I could give you a guess. I could give you a good, solid recipe or formula that often leads somebody to the octagon. But it's not a guarantee. There's no architecture in place. Now, if you ask me how do you win a Super Bowl, I could tell you specifically. I could tell you exactly how the draft works. I could tell you exactly how the playoffs work. I could tell you at the end of four quarters, look up, see who has more points, and that guy leaves with the trophy. There is no architecture like that for the UFC. So when you're given these opportunities, when you're put into a show and into a spot over everybody else, you got to remember that. You got to remember those hard times where you were struggling. You got to remember that there's nobody else out there providing you with this kind of an opportunity or this kind of atmosphere or this kind of a payday. It's the number one out there. And the UFC, on a regular basis, negotiates against themselves. Dana White will sit down at the negotiating table, and he's negotiating against himself, against the own contract that he's already got with a guy. There's nobody else coming in and bidding on them, and he's still giving guys raises.
Right, right. You know, talking on a, and I'm kind of going to veer off into a different road here, but I'm curious to hear your answer to something. We're talking about contracts. We're talking about, you know, getting in the door of places and making your own path and how you choose to do it. GSP chose one way. You chose another. You had said on a previous podcast, and I believe it was on Chris Jericho's podcast, you said you received a phone call from the WWE, and they basically said, Chael, how you doing? Just letting you know, not interested. Let me ask you this. If they had called you and they had said, Chael, we want you today, what would excite you to go there? I mean, are you instantly going, great, send me the contract, I'll meet you in Stanford, and we'll figure it out? Or are you sitting there going, all right, I'm interested too, but here's the way you get me in?
You know, that's, wow, you know, I've never been asked that, John, and that's a true story. WWE called me after I was released from my Fox and UFC contracts, and they just said, hey, we just want you to know we're not interested. And I thought, well, why'd you call me? I haven't had this phone number all that long. It's kind of a new phone. You had to go to some kind of effort to even get my number. And they said, well, we think a competitor, we think TNA is going to make you an offer. And if they do, then we will make you one. We want back in the game. But had they called and said, listen, we want to do a deal, I guess I would have listened. That's not something I want to do. I don't want to go in and jump around with those guys and... I don't know how to do it, for one. You know, I wasn't trained in it. I'm 37 years old. I don't know that I want to live on the road and do that, but that doesn't mean I wanted to listen to him. I mean, if you were asking me how I would have handled that situation, I would have just called Dana. I'd have called. I have a great management company, MMA Inc., the best out there, but I use Dana White a lot as a manager. A lot of times, I can get Dana White on the phone 100% of the time. If I need advice. If I ever send him a text message and I include that phrase, man, I need advice, he will call me instantly. And I can bounce some stuff on him. And he's very freaking smart. And he plays like he's not. He comes out and plays like he's a fight promoter. And he talks about fighting. And he'll slip some profanity in here and there. The guy is freak smart. Excuse me, John. He's smart. And when you get him in business mode, that's where you really start to see it. And when you start talking about deals and you start talking about contracts and you start talking about your future and a vision and how I could want to go about things, there's very few guys you'd want to talk to more than him. And he will level with you as long as you go about it right, as long as you come to him. And you don't try to have a secret. You don't try to do something and shop the UFC and the WWE against each other. You know, you want a good WWF star. I can't give it to you now. I'm actually looking at a time. I have a story I have never told. I have a story I have never told. And you know what? I'm looking at it. I can't do it. I can't do it. That's terrible. I just brought. I won't even give you any details. If I gave you some details, you'd really want to know. But I got a story. Remind me. I owe you a story for another time. But I do want to talk just a little bit of WWE. First thing I want to know, I promised our listeners at the beginning of this show. First, I was bragging at the beginning of the show, John. This show reached number one. Now, the way this works in podcast is it's a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day deal. And they break it down into days. They'll go with a daily ranking, a weekly ranking, and then ultimately a monthly rate ranking. For one day, it reached number one. Now, of course, the goal is to get it there and maintain that. But I was bragging at the beginning of the show about that. And I also told our listeners, if they stick around, I said John is going to tell us his opinion on whether or not Brock Lesnar returns to the UFC. So what say you, my friend?
What a great, great question. I have no facts to base it off of, but I will tell you that I think he will. I think that, I don't know Brock personally. I've never sat down with him and said, talk to me about what motivates you. But, I mean, we're talking about draws. I would venture to say Brock probably was the biggest draw in UFC history. It would be extremely hard for me to imagine the upside of going back to UFC, even on a three-fight deal, to make the kind of money that he can make. Now, personally, do I think he went back to WWE because he loves it? No, I think that the deal was too good to pass up, and that's why he's there. And I think that the same thing's going to happen with UFC. I believe his contract with WWE ends at the end of this WrestleMania, which would be at the beginning of April. I don't know if he's been approached about extending that contract, but I would not at all be surprised if come May of 2015, he's already meeting with Dana White, or if he hasn't already just kind of, you know, thrown the bone that way and kind of said, hey, here's when I want you to call me and I'll see how I'm feeling and we'll go from there. Now, I know that there was a rumor after his last pay-per-view match in WWE, I believe it was last month, he wrestled John Cena, and there were some rumors that there was some health issues. I don't know if that's true. I don't know that if it was, if it's been taken care of or what kind of condition he's in now, because he's been off TV since that match. So who knows? I think if his body will allow him, I think he's going to be there. But I don't know. I think that if the money wouldn't motivate him to go, then I don't know that he would go back. I mean, I don't think that there's a guy on this earth that likes to get in a fight, maybe, you know, outside of Chris Lieben, that he would just go, you know what, I really enjoy dedicating my life to this and waking up at 5 a.m. in the snow and running and, you know, just to make a paycheck. So I think if the money's there, which it will be, I think Brock Lesnar's in the UFC I think he's fighting at the latest January 2016. And that's my prediction. You can write it on your wall and we can see who hits.
You know, I will remind you, though, and you could be right, you could be wrong. I mean, of course, we don't know. That's why you're just making a prediction. But, you know, isn't it more likely, if we're just to talk likelihood, isn't it more likely that if Brock WWE contract is about to run out, he contacts Dana. Isn't it more likely that he's just shopping the two against each other?
Absolutely.
Okay.
100%.
That's the most likely scenario. A guy steps away from the sport, and he didn't exactly step away on top. And I know he had the diverticulitis, and there was some stuff that get pointed to there. But, man, that's life. I certainly don't want to diminish that, but that's a big healthy man, and we're all struggling with different things. And I don't know. I haven't had that. I want to pick my words carefully here, but at the end of the day, I'm saying, so what? You agreed to fight. You got cleared to fight. There's extreme medical conditions you have to go through by the government standards. Okay, we're sanctioned by the government. You raised your hand. You went in there and fought. I've never heard Brock use it as an excuse. I've never heard Brock say it one time. I just heard people say it on his behalf.
Right. Well, I mean, but it could have. Here's the thing, too. I mean, there was rumors all along while he was in UFC that he was going to go wrestle in WWE, even under UFC contract. And I remember Dana getting asked that quite a bit, and him going, "That's not happening." So, you know, what I think happened is he was dealing with this. He went in there. Did he end his last two fights 0-2? I think he lost to Kane, and then he lost to Overeem, and I could be wrong on the order. And I think what happened is WWE came to him and said, look, we'll pay you, and I'm guessing here, $500,000 to every time you wrestle for us, and we need you four times a year. And he said, okay, let me add that on a calculator. Okay, Dana, what do you got? Well, I need you, you know, three times a year, and I'm going to pay you this. And he adds that up, and he goes, all right, well, I can go home and I can eat Doritos as long as I work out harder, or I can fight this illness. And like I've been saying this entire interview, literally dedicate my entire life, 24 hours a day, to preparing to get back in the cage. I think I'm going to go to WWE. But I also think that the money is a lot more lucrative for him going to the UFC. And I think that a thing with Brock, too, is probably sitting there wondering, if I feel great right now, can I hold that title again? And I think he believes that he can. I mean, he's been in there with the current UFC champion. Does he feel that that guy was just a level above him, or that he was not only fighting his body, but fighting Kane at the same time?
Right.
And nobody knows but Brock.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I don't know. And I feel bad for leaving you dangling on that story.
I'm gonna get it out of you off air.
I'll give you a little bit. I don't want to hold out on our listeners either. I'm in a time crunch. You know, I'm new to podcasts. I'm sitting here bragging about being the number one podcast, but that's because the listeners have decided that. So I don't want to leave them hanging on a story here, but at the same time, I got to get off the air. But here's the nuts and bolts of it, John. I was offered $5 million by Vince McMahon. Now, I was still under contract with the UFC, and I never took this to Dana. I handled it on my own. I told him no, and that was the end of that. I've never told Dana White this story, but here was why I didn't tell him. I knew if I called Dana and said, I got a $5 million offer from Vince McMahon, Dana would have matched it. Now, whether that's little or dollar for, you know, Dana would have come close and he would have come forward. And now all of a sudden, I'm not a loyal employee. I'm not loyal to the UFC. I'm shopping them. And I'm being loyal to myself. And that's business. That's the way that works. And I don't think anyone would have had hard feelings. But I didn't see myself that way. You know what, again, it does come down to a little bit the way my contract was structured and getting to be a pay-per-view partner and all these neat things. But at the end of the day, that's really how I felt. I felt like a partner of the UFC. I said, I'm going to handle this. I'm not going to go in and shop them. But where the real story, that's not much of a story. The real story comes in as to what I had to do to get that $5 million. That's always the catch. And
that's what you're going to hold over us.
That's what I'm going to dangle over you for another date. For another date, John, I got my producer, Bill, here, has given me the cutthroat sign, the universal cutthroat sign. He's saying, get off the air. And he's holding up a number one. He's saying, Chael, your show's still going to be number one. John P. Marini, everybody. George St. Pierre was on earlier. You are all very wise for listening. And as always, you're welcome.
Thanks for listening to You're Welcome with Chael Sonnen. Download new episodes every week at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.